This is the Talking Split Podcast.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split Podcast. I am Rob Calder, the Coach Development Coordinator at Basketball Victoria. Joined this week by the man with fresh ink that did not give us the opportunity to hold a Talking Split fan survey to find out what the new ink should look like. Nathan Cooper-Brown, welcome back to the pod.
Great to be here, Rob.
And the head coach for the Vic Country Women's Program, Zoe Carr, welcome.
You didn't put as much effort into my introduction.
You're here every week.
I'm fairly disappointed.
You're here every week.
We're off to a good start. Yeah,
that's just how it works. So, coaches, we do appreciate all the likes, the shares, the ratings, the reviews, the retweets that you throw out for the podcast. It is always nice to throw the coaching assist and have additional people listen to the podcast. Thanks for those that jumped in with some emails and some comments on Dr. Alex Lascu last week talking about skill acquisition. That was fantastic. And again, a big thanks to Alex for sharing the pod along the way. Always appreciate it. Might be a very quick podcast today because we've just closed the door in here. We've got the 27-degree day and the heater is going somehow. I don't know how this has happened, but this may be the world's fastest podcast, depending on how well this goes. We'll look like sultanas at the end of this thing, but who knows? So one thing before we sort of get into the nuts and bolts, I did mention last week we'd be talking about senior coaching this week. One thing I do want to highlight, I'll play the audio first and we'll go from there.
I don't know, this is probably not going to be overly popular what I'm going to say, but I'm old and I've been around quite a bit. And I think that, John really is a hell of a coach. And there's a lot of really, really good young coaches in this league that are getting the crap beat out of them. I'm not talking on the floor, but I'm talking through all the media and stuff that happens to these guys. And this guy's got a tremendous amount to offer to this franchise and these other coaches that are around the league. You know, you're quite vulnerable sitting out there as a coach and as a young coach, what I've been there, of family being attacked in social media, people telling you you're the greatest, the stupidest, the smartest, whatever it may be. This guy over here is high quality, and there's a lot of really good young coaches in here, and I just wish people would take a little bit off the gas on some of these guys. I know it's a business and I know it's entertainment, but let these guys be who they are and let them coach and live with what some of the things are going to happen. And I just really am quite respectful of coaching, but the younger coaches in particular, because I know how difficult a job like this is. And old, you can throw darts and everything at me, I don't really care, but please, be mindful. These people got families, kids, and it irks me quite a bit when I see a guy that's working his butt off like this guy is over here, and people are just pouncing on him.
So preach.
That's the audio from the head coach of the Tasmania Jack Jumpers, Scott Roth. He was and audio courtesy of Brent Costello as well from down in Tassie. That is a phenomenal message. Like, and this probably exemplifies the franchise as a whole. The Jack Jumpers have been phenomenal by the point they get Jack Fleming from Basketball Victoria. Huge win there. Always a great pickup. But
you're looking for a retweet?
Not at all. Like, Fleming's good in that space, so we're all good. But it is just, it sums up, I feel like, the culture they've got working down there as an organisation. And you can see how it's led by Scott Roth as well when you hear the passion in his voice with that. But you also think about it from a human perspective. Coaching can sometimes get lost in this whole thing. And you know, he's been through the ringer, obviously, as a coach, and you hear just the passion he speaks about and just the understanding and emotional intelligence around coaches go through a lot more than just the on-court stuff. Mm. Like, there's so much more to that than just, you know, you win and lose games, and if you lose games, you're going to get smashed for it. And whether that be junior, senior basketball doesn't really matter in the whole grand scheme of things. So the coaching fraternity is a really important one, and to hear a coach stick up for someone else in that same space, that whether we like it or not, they're competitors. Like, all coaches are competitors in that space. To hear that, and I feel like he would have had that same view and impression even if they dropped the game. Like, I don't think that's a win-loss dependent reaction to it. And that's the first thing he said in his presser.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't come out and wait halfway through or anything like that. It was from the get-go, here's what I believe. A coach doing a great job, a young, supportive coach. Yeah, that's a great space to be in. And I think a great show of culture and respect in the coaching fraternity, which is vitally important, I feel.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, the message is amazing. It's something, you know, as a coaching group within here, we've tried to convey often. The best part about it, though, that was completely unprompted. Yep. He wasn't asked about John Reilly's performance or what he thought or anything like that. He literally sat down in his chair and went there to basically say, you know, I'm behind this coach, you know, understand what this is all about. This is more than just, you know, decisions that you make in the heat of the battle. You know, he just went in there with a show of support straight off the bat. And I think, you know, half of the problem with the culture, I think, that can be within coaching is exactly what you said, Rob. We're competitors. You know, there's only a certain amount of jobs or there's certain jobs that we want, and sometimes we get them, sometimes we don't. And that can lead to disappointment, you know, the old Yoda saying, you know, fear leads to hate leads to suffering sort of thing. And it's that sort of, I guess, thought of, you know, if you're disappointed, you want someone to blame, and often you point the blame at the wrong person who's the one who's got the job that you want. So, you know, for him to have just walked in there and said, no, I'm taking a stand on this, don't bother coming at me with any, you know, questions about him or, you know, or their performance or anything like that, because as a coach, I support this coach, is just amazing and an amazing example. And like you said, the Jack Jumpers, I don't know, they've put a foot wrong since they stepped into the league from a culture perspective. You know, on court, they had a great season last year. Their season's probably not running as it was last year, but nobody really seems to care because their culture, like, they still love them. They still support them because their culture is what it is, and it's from the top down. And he's just a tremendous example of, you know, what a coach should be.
Well, it's coming from an understanding too of that's a guy that's coached in Perth. That probably understands, you know, this has been a massive franchise, and he was a big part of why they were successful as well. So he probably understands that, you know, you're going to hear the noise and that sort of stuff. And I have no doubt there are coaches from within the NBL and WNBL and various other leagues that still do show support, but probably not in the public space like that. Like, it's, I mean, we're all coaches. We coach against people. Sometimes we like them, sometimes we don't like them, but there is an obvious respect there that sometimes we just shoot a text and just go, hey, bit of a tough one tonight, or whatever the case may be, got your back with it all the way through. Like, that sort of stuff is really comforting, I find, for a lot of other coaches. Like, I mean, Coos, what are your thoughts on it? Like, you've heard that as well. Like, it's a pretty impressive message.
Yeah, it is. It's fantastic to hear a coach go into that sort of depth of support and care and love for someone else in the fraternity. I think it's also important the way, or any time that we can pull back the veil a bit on who coaches are. You know, they are human beings. They do have families. And none of them want to lose. John really hasn't gone to Perth to tick off the Wildcat fan base and lose. And it's not like he's walking out of, you know, the RAC centre and, you know, and not watching film and going home and kicking his feet up and laughing. He's like, I can't believe, it doesn't work that way. This guy is there because he loves to coach. He's there because he saw something in that organization. He's recruited hard. He's cutting film. He's putting practice. He's doing all the things that we do, whether you coach under 12s or, you know, you coach professionally, you know, and sometimes it just doesn't happen, you know, and we just need to be conscious of that, you know, these people are human beings and, you know, that should factor in any time that we want to start taking pot shots from the cheap seats.
And that's, like, I saw something the other day. I was looking at just flicking through my usual Man City news for the week. And it was an article about how Pep Guardiola and Jose Mourinho just connected. Both of them lost parents at the time and supported each other through that whole thing. And it's like, these dudes are competitors. Like, they see each other, you know, depending on what league they're in at the time, for cups, for the actual league play and all that sort of stuff. They're probably in the same transfer market after the same players and get a little bit salty when they go to the other team and all those types of things. But just the actual, no, person first. Like, it's, this is not about the win and the loss stuff. It becomes about the win and the loss because we talk about professional leagues and the like. And, you know, that is obviously a big deal. But the person, like, that's really the most important part in this whole space.
Yeah. And it's not even just the thing that blows my mind is that this sort of, I guess, attacking and, you know, horrible culture that we can have in the coach fraternity, it's not just subject to professional level. You know, some of the stuff that I read, comments, tweets, you know, all that sort. I don't go on forums. I used to when I was a young coach, and that was stupid. That was because there was stuff on there about me and how terrible I was. And I used to take it personally, and I don't go on there anymore. But
the username Brian Cooper.
Yeah.
don't read anything into that. Like it's, no, to be fair, Coops would tell you to your face. Like
yeah, exactly right.
Yeah, true.
But for, you know, while a Nationals is on or something like that, it's just, I just think exactly what you're saying, Coops. Can we just remember that these are humans? These are people. You know, whether it's professional level, whether it's junior level, you know, it's put yourself in that position.
And the noise usually comes from, I find, people that aren't in those coaching roles.
Or haven't been.
Like, they don't understand it. Like, I think it's not until you've gone through it can you really understand what it's like to have dropped a game you didn't want to lose or, you know, had the season go not the way you wanted it to go, I suppose, in that space. So I must admit, from the coaching perspective, I have actually found it to be fairly supportive across the board. Like, I don't think it's a bad culture in coaching by any stretch of the imagination, but there's certainly some areas that are better than others. Mm. There's no question about that. So it is a good message, I feel, for juniors and senior coaches, is just be supportive in that space. Like, you don't really know what the other person's going through in their personal life and away from that. Like, coaching for them might be that 90 to 120-minute release where they can just forget about all the other stuff that's going on. They're able to actually go and coach and do something they enjoy, and then they may have to go and deal with whatever they have to deal with after that. But just remember the human element, I suppose, overall.
Well, the great part was, though, that little, clip of that part of the press conference, I saw that everywhere. Yep. People retweeting it, sharing it, you know, sending it around. I think I got it sent to me by about 5 different people, you know. All that sort of stuff I think is fantastic that, you know, and that's a leader. You know, he's been a leader in that space and he's used his platform to be able to spread something positive that we can all, I guess, try and live up to.
Yep, absolutely. So what a segue into senior coaching. So I did touch on this a little bit last week that we were going to tackle this one because it is an area, to be honest, we're like 80-odd episodes in. We haven't spoken about senior coaching once to this point. So it is an area that's probably a little bit more niche that not everyone or the vast majority of our listeners would be coaching senior basketball. But there is probably limited understanding around how that senior space works, what it looks like, how do you get involved in it if you want to get involved with it, what are the pros and cons of it, you know, those types of things. So Zoe, you mentioned the other week you prefer coaching seniors to juniors if you had to pick between one or the other. Coops, what about you?
Yeah, seniors for me. One, because the junior schedule or calendar in Victoria is just ridiculous. So the fact that you're coaching 13 months out of a 12-month calendar.
Smart weather.
Yeah, exactly. It's just wild. So the fact that you get an off-season, you get a chance to evaluate, prepare.
Pre-seasons are coming earlier and earlier, though.
Yeah, they are.
I must admit, finals finish and then 2 weeks out. Yeah, look, here's just some conditioning stuff for you if you want to do it.
That's right. And then also just for me personally, where I'm at with my coaching, I like establishing relationships with, older athletes, that I can have more meaningful conversations with, you know, can coach a level of basketball that's more about a chess game and more about helping athletes, kind of at the peak of their performance and potentially go on to some really cool things. So, so seniors for me.
Yep. And Debbie, what was your reasoning behind seniors over juniors?
Well, mine was if it's a coaching, like a season, seniors, if it's in development, juniors. But much like Coops, the chess game with the opposition coach is always a little more fun. You can see some stuff. Stuff tends to come up that maybe you're not expecting, whereas it tends to be a little predictable. And it has to be because they're young. You can't go and throw in, extensive concepts and things with 12-year-olds, So certainly not throwing any shade at that. But the ability to be able to do more and try more and, you have to be able to read the game at a quicker pace, almost 3 steps ahead, because by the time you actually notice what's happening, process it, then make the change, that's already changed again. That constant on your toes type stuff, the ability to put something into a scout and then actually watch it come to fruition on the floor is pretty cool.
So when we're looking in that senior space in particular, like what are some of the various parties, I suppose, you're going to have to deal with? Like, it's not as simple as I'm just going to turn up and coach my team. So, I mean, Coots, you've been in that position in a number of different clubs, in particular from like a director of coaching perspective down to just being the senior coach. So what are the sort of the areas, I suppose, that you found in that space?
Yeah, look, kind of folds into, you know, multiple layers of who you're going to be connected with, who wants to be connected with the club, who has genuine, I guess for a lack of a better term, power over, you know, how that team is going to be structured. It starts at the top, you know, your CEO or president or, you know, general manager. So that person running the club, obviously they're usually the money person. So starting there around their expectations of what they want to spend, you know, how is that going to relate to winning? You know, you want to have a really clear understanding of those things. And then you want to have a good relationship with that person too. Something I was listening to Eddie Howe, the manager of Newcastle, and he was talking about, he just in his time away from the game, was talking about meeting with, you know, technical directors and some higher ups at big soccer clubs, and he was talking about the way that those people see the coach and the relationship that they want to have with the coach is really important in terms of the hiring and firing. And hearing him talk about that was a little bit of a light bulb moment for me too, in when I've been in those situations and I've able to go and ask for more money or maybe do something a little bit different has been, you know, so heavily linked to that relationship. So starts there. Then there's director of coaches. You know, some have, you know, are really hands-on with the senior team. Some aren't. Some, you know, have been told their portfolio is purely with the juniors. I've had the experience of being a director of coaching and coaching, you know, in the semi-professional senior team. I really liked that. I thought it married up really well. And again, the relationship I had with my CEO at the time allowed us to do that. And then there's also some committees. So also been in a situation where we had a senior elite teams committee, who were really hands-on, you know, helped with recruiting, helped with advertising, helped with, you know, creating and providing resources. And again, it's a relationship business. So, you know, creating those relationships, fostering them, helping those people understand your vision, you know, being really clear about that. We're all, you know, really important aspects of, you know, getting senior coaching kind of off, you know, off the ground before we even thought about, you know, system apply or recruiting or anything like that.
Yeah. The Eddie Howe podcast you mentioned as well, the high performance podcast, yeah, is with Damien Hugh. That's a great listen.
Yeah. Highly recommend.
Like I mean, he's a soccer coach that's obviously got fired from a previous position and said no to a lot of roles, in that time where other people were trying to recruit him, and just listening to his reasoning behind why they said no and those types of things. It's a really interesting listen. So I do recommend any coaches out there that are listening to this podcast, double down, more podcasts. Go and jump into that one as well. It's a really good listen in that space. So are there any others that you sort of found in your time that you have to deal with?
No, not really. I think Coops has probably hit it on the head there. You know, I think it's really important to, if your DOC isn't directly hands-on or directly involved, that you do really need a good relationship with them, because whether a club tells you it or not, they will want as many of their juniors transitioning into their senior team, because at the end of the day, the majority of who's paying for those teams are junior programs, whether it be junior domestic, junior reps. So, you know, you have a responsibility to try and get those athletes to transition into your program. Now, to do that, the DOC needs to be across what, you know, as Coop said, what your vision is, what you require, what, you know, what are the pillars that the athletes need to possess to be able to do that. So then that can filter down through to the program and make an easier and a stronger transition.
So who needs to drive that then? So is that the senior coach that has to drive that, or is that the director of coaching that has to drive that? Because both have limited lifespans, and if you've coached a senior a certain way based on your senior coach, those under 12 kids come to under 18s, for argument's sake, that senior coach is gone. Like, how important is it to get like an understanding that it's not just a 2-year sort of cycle?
Yeah, so it'd be the case of, so let's say I'm the DOC, you walk in and you're the head coach and you say, I want all of my, all the junior teams running exclusively flow and nothing else. Well, I'm going to turn around to you and say no. But what we might do is then put an emphasis on flow concepts. So, you know, the back cut, being able to read and make the back cut and make the pass, you know, the coming off the pitch and on ball and all those sort of things. So whilst then I'm not throwing in an offense that, you know, then once they get into seniors, that's the only thing they can run. But they'll have an understanding of flow, but through concept teaching. And so then if by the time that the kid in under 14s gets to seniors, if you've been moved on or you have moved on and somebody else comes in, they still have an understanding of concepts and can then go into that program without a problem.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest part too. I mean, you alluded to it before. Everyone wants their juniors in their senior program. But the reality is if you get one kid per age group that goes on to play senior basketball from that's juniors huge. Into seniors, that's phenomenal. Yeah. Like, 'cause it just doesn't tend to happen that way.
Especially if you're at the NBL 1 level.
Absolutely. Like, it may happen a little bit in the lower leagues, in particular, like that youth league type space. Absolutely. Like, you would expect in that space there should be a fair bit of transition. But it's really difficult to put a numerical perspective on we need X amount of players from our junior program in our senior program. And I understand why people do it too. Like, it's, you know, that's a kid that's potentially been at the club since under eights or something like that. You know, everyone wants to look at the pathway. And, oh, look at this pathway. And it's like, yeah, but that's theirs. That's not necessarily
it's not
how
everyone's.
It's going to work for everyone else. You know, if some kid walks in at 6'8" and 17 years old, you're probably going to take a chance on them, even if they haven't been there from under eights. So it is going to be a little bit different for everyone in that space, but it is difficult when you're looking at, you know, what do we want our actual senior team to be? Do we want it to be a representation of our club or association, in which case you may need to shelve winning because they don't always relate? Or do you want it to be a winning program, in which case you may not have the junior athletes coming through that can equate to that? Or you may sit there and say, well, hey, by the time you hit under 18s or under 20s, it's a free-for-all. We're taking the best people for the best positions in that space. And that's the clarity of role you spoke about, Coops. Like, what is the vision from the board level, the CEO level, the admin level? How do you, I suppose, navigate those waters?
Yeah, you hit it on the head. It is. It's the established strategic plan that the club has laid out, and then, you know, within that plan, they should be providing resources and support to help the head coach execute that. And then it's back on the head coach to say, okay, well, this is their plan. They laid it out. You know, I've taken the job knowing that this is their vision. Here's my vision. How do we fold those things in together and move on to have success? So, you know, of course, I'm going to draw heavily on my own experience, you know, throughout the pod. And I've been lucky to kind of be all over the shop, youth, NBL 1, Siebel. And one of my most recent experiences, the club had a no import, no cars, no accommodation, and basically the lowest budget in the league, almost no budget at all. So within those constraints was, we want our juniors played. We want a homegrown philosophy. We're happy to lose. Like, we spoke about winning and losing. That was like, they said, yep, we don't mind.
How'd you deal with that?
It was difficult. It's nice to have the lowered expectations in knowing that, yeah, look, we probably are going to lose because we're going to go play teams that have $150,000 budgets, and we're on 15. So the likelihood of us winning those games is pretty low. Did that deter my competitiveness and my horrible white line fever? No, definitely not.
It does take a lot of it's a tough one because I feel like they've almost given you an out there as well. It's look, if this job is not for you, no problem. Like, if these are the parameters and you're not comfortable with those, that's fine. Don't take the role.
They definitely said that, to their credit. Like, they definitely said that. And it was on me, and I knew going in that this was going to be a real challenge. And I spoke to the people around me. I mean, I spoke to you guys about it, you know, before, during and after. And I said, you know, this is going to be really difficult, but it's going to make me a better coach. It's going to force me to be innovative. It's going to force me to look at the game in a different way. And I knew that challenge. And as much as I knew that going in, you know, not so I sound like a super coach, I had some really dark moments. It got to points where, you know, losing however many games in a row and still finding that really difficult because I hate losing.
We all do. Like, it's not unique, and that's the hardest. But like, we all are all competitive. Like, yeah. We have this beautiful thing in juniors where it's just like, ah, well, we lost, but players just didn't turn up tonight.
Yeah.
So whatever. Like, very rarely does the less talented team win in junior basketball. Whereas in senior basketball, the less talented team can absolutely jag a win the right time based on coaching, tactic, whatever the case may be. Like, it's a different space.
Yeah. I mean, something we did culture-wise, which was essential, is that we had a discussion with the group prior to the season, basically saying, hey, look, this is going to be tough and we're probably going to lose a lot of games, without saying that. You know, we restructured it and spoke about what does success look like for us. And we tried to remove winning and losing out of it. You know, that, you know, success for us looked like, you know, a locker room post game that had joy in it and had connection to it. You know, success for us was guys coming back in on Monday or Tuesday, eager to get better and compete again. So that was a real credit to my staff and to the athletes that we had to really just to buy into that part of the philosophy and the culture. Which really helped me, you know, that they could come back to that even at some dark times and say, hey, you know, we're still enjoying this thing, and or I'm still creating really good relationships, or, you know, we love coming back and being connected to the club. So, you know, again, I think that's part of that setup process of, you know, what does this thing look like? You know, how are we connected between staff and club, and how are we all moving, you know, towards that same vision?
Yeah, and I mean, Zoe, you've been in a fairly similar position. Your first year in senior basketball, obviously, as a head coach, was a similar sort of role. Like, you had limited budget, limited resources, those types of things, but limited players too.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you didn't have a roster of 15. Like,
no,
roster
we
of about 8,
didn't.
It felt like at times.
Yeah, we went into several games with 7 and 8 players, which was – it was tough, but as Coop said, I wouldn't change it, because the – development I got out of that year as a coach was huge. You know, I learned how to coach my way through every single possession. I didn't get a chance to just sit down and take a breath. Like, I had to be on top of everything, similar to what I said before. I had to be ahead of everything, even more so, because, you know, I think we've mentioned it on the pod and you've mentioned it before, Rob, like, it would take us 40 minutes to win games, but we could lose them in 10. And so
10 might be a bit generous. Like, it felt like I'm not
we didn't
smart,
lose by
like,
much.
No, you didn't. Like, but genuinely, like in senior basketball, like, it can only take 2 or 3 minutes,
yeah,
and all of a sudden a 2-point lead's a 15-point lead, and
yeah,
you know, you've kind of missed your opportunity there.
Yeah.
Like, it's,
so
it's tough.
Things like, oh, do I take the time out? I didn't have time for that. Yeah. You know, I had to figure that out and be right more often than not. Now, I'm not saying that I was. I definitely, you know, there were times I was like, damn, that was the wrong time, or, you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, but that's the learning. And I think sometimes we get, as coaches, if we're not, we go for a role and when, you know, we have a club that's, and it's so refreshing to hear, Coops, that the club you were at was honest with you about what the situation was going to be, because everything we've been speaking about so far is like best case scenario. You won't find that anywhere, because more often than not, these programs are relying on, you know, part-time employees, volunteers, yep, you know. So don't think you're walking into, whilst it might be an NBL 1 organization or something like that, don't think you're walking into the Bulls. Like, it's not happening. Yeah. So the fact that they were honest with you is amazing. But I think sometimes we find, oh, we get that information and, you know, our budget's going to be this, and it may not be a competitive budget. These are your constraints and things like that. So then it's, oh, okay, well, I'm not going to take that role. It's like, hold on a second. You know, what I think for – and I use him because he's the first one that comes off the top of my head. But for like a Dean Vickerman, okay, no worries. Like, you've done your time. You've had your go at coaching those sort of teams and
yeah,
all that sort
more
of stuff.
Opportunity.
You've got yeah. If you're a young coach and you're given an opportunity to be in the trenches like that, take it. Yeah. Like, take it, because at the end of the day, you're going to learn so much from it. people will help you if you ask them for it, and you're open to it. But I, you know, after that year, I had two fairly successful years, and I didn't learn anywhere near as much as I did in that first year. So, you know, I think sometimes, and I was the same young coach. We want it laid out so we can show what we can do and, you know, be successful. Because if we see it as if we're not successful, then people will think we can't coach.
Yep,
whereas
absolutely.
In that program, I actually turned more heads in that program than any other program I've been involved in because of what I was able to do with that group. So, you know, I think, yeah, take a step back sometimes and think, hey, whilst it's not the ideal utopia, there's still something, one, I can get out of it, and two, that can help me develop.
Well, even senior coaching, though, it's still similar to juniors. There's probably only three, maybe four teams that can actually win it every year.
Mm.
So chances are you're not getting a job that, you know, is a title team.
For your first job,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
For your first job, like, your first, you know, go at it.
10 years
yeah.
in, maybe. But yeah. that first one is always going to be a suck it and see, do I want to do this? Am I any good at doing this? Can I... not necessarily leveraging into a better position, but can I build something over the course? Like, mm. is this something that you're able to impact the culture of the club or the association? I think is actually a really valuable area to be in. I mean, we've touched on budgets a little bit here, and I suppose it's probably one of the areas that's almost a little bit sort of secret squirrel. Like, no one really knows what everyone else's budget yeah. is. Like, you ask anyone, it's like, what's your budget? And if it's 60, they oh, like 25. Like, it's, you know,
yeah.
Oh, really? You managed to get that for 20? When we're talking budgets and things like that, how big a difference does your budget make to the team you can put on the floor? Because it's not like juniors where it's just like, oh, look, it's fairly
Turned
equal.
Up to Charles.
Yeah, that's who we have. So that's who we have. Like, how big a difference does budget make in
it's
that
huge.
Space? Yeah.
It's huge at the, particularly at NBL 1 level, it's massive. You know, it's the difference between finals and, you know, toward the bottom end of the ladder. But I never really understood the angst towards budget. So, you know, you'd often hear teams with low budget and then, you know, you hear what another team, what their budget is or allegedly is. People get annoyed at that. I always think, well, good for them. They're actually paying players probably what they're worth yeah. or what they deserve and... well done. Like, I've, you know, if you're not at one of those clubs, I wish my, you know, the club I was at would have that same sort of budget. I think it's great if we can, you know, across the board get it to that sort of level. But, yeah, if you don't have a competitive budget, it makes it very, very difficult, especially if you're not a coach on, say, like a – which isn't at that level anyway, but you know, like if you're on an Opals bench or a Boomers bench, well, then you're probably a bit different because people will come to play for you, you know, for that added opportunity or, you know, added exposure and that sort of stuff. But, yeah, it's really tough to compete with the higher-end budgets because budget brings depth and depth eventually will win out.
So how do you use that budget responsibly, Coops? Because that's the – like, we've all been on, like, 2K and it's like, yeah, I'll just buy this player for this amount of money and didn't work out, reset, like, no worries. But how do you go about using that money responsibly that you have towards your playing roster?
Just quickly to double down on what Zoe was talking about, on the men's side of the program, the budget is everything. It's everything. It's how you get talent, and at that level and above, you can't win without talent. So
even your homegrown players,
yeah,
like you, I mean, you're not getting them for free just
That's
because
right.
they've been at your club
exactly.
or anything like that. Like, you're still going to have to pay those players.
100%. They're going to get to a point where they see their value and they want to be fairly compensated. And I was like Zoe as well, that any time a player that I was trying to recruit would say, hey, look, I've been offered, you know, this a trumping offer from somewhere else, I'd be like, go.
Mm.
Yeah.
Take it. Like, great job. Enjoy it. If things change in the future, you know, look forward to chatting again. Just to come back to your question in terms of how do we spend the money, something that we did at my time in Ballarat was we knew we needed depth. We knew that we needed top-tier talent, but we weren't necessarily willing to pay, you know, one or two or three guys. We wanted to see that we could stretch it, but also have enough talent to compete. Because, you know, we're lucky in the country, it's a little bit different. You know, you get a lot of advertising,
sponsors,
different ways that the budget opens up, rather with Metro that usually, like you said before, Zoe, about, you know, that the domestic competition potentially covers majority of the budget. So we spoke about the development play, NBL development players. The club really wanted to import, so they thought that connected well with the community. And then my input was, okay, well, let's go and get some of these NBL guys, but let's not go pay top-tier NBL and then it's, you know, two imports and maybe one superstar. It was, okay, let's go and look, who are these fringe guys who are looking to make that jump, you know, maybe from a development player to a full contract or kind of floating on, you know, 11th, 12th and want to make the next step. And that was a really good place for us to start because we didn't have to pay them as much. It meant we could get two or three, you know, compared to one. And it also framed how we were kind of not only structuring our program but how we were marketing it. So we actually put together a brochure and kind of had it laid out about all the things that we'd worked really hard to put into place for our senior team. So I remember I went and got a contra deal with a local yoga studio. And so Monday night, you know, after the weekend, we had yoga recovery, you know, and the idea was this is marrying up with NBL clubs, NBA clubs, you know, European clubs that are finding, you know, all these ways to help create a holistic environment for development. And that's what we would say to these athletes, to say, hey, come here. This is going to be the most professional environment that you can get outside of, you know, basically NBL or above. And we're going to help you get better and get that next NBL or European contract. And it worked really well. You know, one of the guys, you know, Peter Hooley, obviously, you know, then went on to Melbourne United and, you know, won a, I think, championship or two. Craig Moller, who's now playing professionally in Europe. Sam Short. So we picked up some guys, you know, with that philosophy that that were really good. And it helped us. It helped us with the budget. And I would highly recommend something similar to all those coaches out there in a similar spot in terms of how do we spend our money. You know, show that you can get people better. And then try and tap into the talent that's around that level.
And that's the hard part. Like you touched on the talent. There are some players that will simply be chasing a paycheck.
Oh, yeah.
Like that's why they're playing senior basketball. And credit to them. Like if they can do that, good luck to them. There's always someone that's prepared to pay them. So, you know, they'll find the money somewhere, I guess. But it is like you have to sell. And when I say sell, it sounds like a real dirty word. But you have to sell the fact that the opportunity and the development that you can get with you is going to be worth taking potentially less than you can get somewhere else.
Spot on.
And that's the valuable part of it. And I mean, you better back it up. Like if you're going to tell them this is what we're going to offer, you better follow through with that thing because and players will change. Like a lot of them will say, well, look, I can either get paid, but I probably won't win because, you know, if I'm taking the lion's share of the budget, you know, there's probably not going to be much left for anyone else. Or I can go and develop, but I can be part of a good team because I'm taking less money, but that's going to get spread across a few more people, and now we have a seventh and eighth player that can kind of contribute a little bit. You're that's laughing at me.
Yeah, I am, because that is what you would think they would think.
Yeah,
they
no,
don't.
It's not. Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, so let's talk the real elephant in the room, agents.
Oh,
here we go.
Yeah, so when we're talking, you know, the absence of parents in senior basketball, then you replace them with agents. Don't get me wrong. They are necessary, and they are necessary because there have been instances where clubs or coaches or have done wrong by athletes and taken them for granted and, you know, all that sort of stuff, knowing that they're not aware of, you know, what's actually happening. They've just signed on to the dotted line and off they go. So some are certainly better than others. Some are really difficult to work with and you have to – what I would say is it's sort of similar to like if you were going to buy a house, right? Go in with what your price is and that is it. And if they – and be okay or content with them walking away.
Oh, but I can just get an extra $500. Can you just match that for me?
No. See you later.
Yeah. We've all got, and let's face it, every coach out there has been bitten by that. Like, absolutely. Oh, yeah. If you can just find an extra $1,000, they're yours. Yeah. And it's like, oh, really? And what's your cut? Like, it's,
yeah.
You know, this is the dangerous part. And it's, if you get closer to the season, you might have missed out on a couple of other players. All of a sudden, it's like, yeah, but if we can just get this
the
extra.
The panic sets in.
Yeah, yeah. And you just get, like, it's sort of like gambling, chase your losses, don't chase your losses. podcast not sponsored by anyone affiliated with gambling. But that's the danger of it.
It's tough. And it's. And they do. They're very good at what they do. They, you know, they make you feel like you're about like just this little bit more could help you get this athlete that's going to change your world. And, you know, that's their job, and they're great at it. But as a coach, I would just say, find your line, stick to your line, and don't be swayed, because at the end of the day, like I mentioned, buying a house, it's like real estate agent type stuff. You know, they want, their job is to get the most amount of money for their client. So, you know, what you think that athlete's worth and what they think the athlete is worth, at the end of the day, what they think they're worth is irrelevant. It's what you think they're worth and what you're willing to pay. But again, you then have to be content with the fact that they may walk. So just always
remembering who they're there for. Yeah. But they're not there for you as correct. The coach.
Exactly.
They're there for their client.
And like I said, they're good at their jobs.
Yeah,
you know, it's, so, you know, just making sure that, you know, you've got your plan Bs ready, you're good to go. One thing I will say is it's, as someone, if people that know me listening to the pod will know I have a tendency to flash the emotional. And thankfully I haven't done this, but I could see myself doing it. When you get into some of these conversations and, you know, the game playing and all that sort of stuff, you must stay calm. You must, and regardless if they walk away, you have to treat them with the same respect as you would if it was an athlete, you know, because at the end of the day, they may hold the key to a season for you and you've mouthed off or, you know, called them whatever you want to call them or, you know, again, played games back with them, you know, not returning calls or emails or things like that. And then you come after this player and all of a sudden, I can assure you, it will be that agent that is representing them and now you're up against it. So, you know, you've got to stay professional and stay classy with all that, all those negotiations and always end it on a positive note of, hey, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for the opportunity. You know, I hope in the future, you know, if you've got any other athletes that are looking for an opportunity, please don't feel free to reach out and sort of leave it like that. So,
and it's not always money related with these types of things either. Like some of them, I mean, you alluded to it before, Coops, like some of it is accommodation, car, gym memberships, those types of things. So these are like not everything is that's what they're getting paid. It might be that's what they're getting paid, but these are through Contra or whether it be sponsors or whatever the case may be. These are the additional extras, or this is all they're getting. Like we're talking about like budgets and imports and that sort of stuff. If you're coaching Division Two somewhere, your budget is literally they're paying to play. Like it's not the same thing everywhere. Yeah. So you do have to be really conscious. But it is a question that I would be asking at the interview or the appointment process. What is my budget? Mm. Walking like what do I have to deal with here? If I can go and find X amount of dollars from, are you happy for that to go towards it? Or whether it be, like I said, gym memberships or whatever the case may be. Like it is something you do have to be conscious of that not everyone will have a budget. It's not always a fair and equal playing ground. Like I know we were talking about it not too long ago. Sometimes it's a good thing to get imports in because they're there just for you.
Yeah.
Like it's they're yours to use for your team. Whereas sometimes, and I know you've been this way, Zoe, and I'm very much down this path as well. I'll be interested to hear yours too, Coops. We kind of have that view that the senior programs like the NBL 1 and those types of things should be used for our players. It's not necessarily import driven. It's an opportunity for our players to either A, get paid, or B, improve, C, represent their club that they've potentially come through along the way. So with that comes some risk that if you are going the NBL, WNBL athlete, they may not be there at the start of the season. They may not be there at the end of the season. Are you prepared to deal with that if that's the case? And not everyone is. So, I mean, Coops, where do you sort of sit in that space? I feel like I know your answer, but where do you sit on that?
Yeah, the first part, I think, is when you're bringing, whether they're an import or an NBL player or, you know, an elite professional into your club for that season, I think there should be an expectation that they are a club person. that they are with you for that, you know, whatever it may be, 6-7 months, you know, that they get involved in the junior pathway. They're making themselves available on a Friday night. They're getting out to schools in the area. They're wearing their polo or their top, and they're you know, enjoying more of a community-based basketball experience, because the community is the one who's paying them. Yeah, they may think that it's the club, but it's not. It's the community that's associated with the club, again, whether it's domestic or the sponsors or whoever. And so, you know, part of, you know, your recruiting strategy has to have a character aspect to it. You know, what is the character of these young men and women, and are they going to come and invest in this whole process? And show the community why, you know, we should have senior teams at community level, which I think we should. I think it's a fantastic thing that we have and a pathway that we provide. So yeah, I'm really big on that part. In terms of, you know, import kind of versus NBL and how that's structured to your season, obviously again the expectations. Okay, are we looking to win the championship? Are you giving me a budget that says we want to go and compete for a championship? So straight away, I want to know I've got my best players at the end of the year. So when we get to the pointy end, I want to know who's going to be there. So imports, obviously, I know they're going to be there. I can sign a contract that says, yep, you've got to stick around till the championship game. So that one's a little bit, that's a given. With the NBL guys, again, that's where I looked a little bit more towards the end of the bench and the DPs. And then was having conversations with their CEOs or their head coaches throughout that recruiting process and saying, hey, look, we're putting together something pretty special here. We think we can go and win it. When it gets to that point, I know you're in preseason. What does this thing look like? And I made sure that I had them on record saying, yep, those guys are going to be available for you. You know, you're going to have them. Now, it came with a compromise. Obviously, this is my time in Ballarat, which is, again, a little bit different with the country. You know, the guys kind of are in a country town and environment, so there's lots of positives that come with that. But when it got to that stage, I think I only had the guys training once a week. I think they were coming up on Thursday, training Thursday night. I think we were shooting Friday, and then obviously we were playing on the weekend. And then it basically, as soon as the game had finished or the next day, they were straight back to Melbourne, you know, into their NBL stuff. So there was a compromise with it, but it was, again, about those relationships and saying, hey, are we in this thing together? Okay, great. You know, let's sign on the dotted line and get moving.
Okay, so now you're starting to get into the pro versus semi-pro versus playing for the love of the game space, because you have different rules for different athletes within that program. How do you go about approaching that and making sure everyone's still on the same page, just for unity and less stress on your end more than anything else?
That's a great question. What I like to do is really establish player roles as quickly as possible. So we would have a one-on-one discussion. So I would create a little bit of an outline of what I thought their role was going to look like. Then we would have a 1v1 discussion, and if those guys wanted to add something to the role, we could do that. And then we would actually have their role, you know, either laminated or however it was, and we would stick it up in their locker room, and we would have a team meeting that also connected with that. So the idea was everybody had to sign their player role to say, yes, I agree to this. This is who I'm going to be. This is what I'm going to commit to the team.
And if I don't, I'm giving the keys to my Carter Coops.
Yeah.
On the way through. Like, his playing budget looked a lot better the next year.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, everybody gets a car. And then having the discussion around the team and actually saying, hey, guys, look, Zoe's a WNBL athlete. You know, she's at this point of her career. We've had this conversation. We know that she's going to be here for this part. She's going to miss that. But still on the weekend, you know, the expectation is, you know, we're going to run a lot of the offense through her and so on. And we went around the room and basically you were kind of either in or you're out. And we would preface that also by saying that this is what professional basketball is.
Like, did anyone have the guts to say they were out?
Not at that time, but we definitely had the gripes that came up through the season. But then it was by having the player roll up in their locker and having everybody know whose role was whose, that we could have those conversations. Kind of like what I was talking about previously on the pod about motivational interviewing, is to go back and say, okay, well, you're a little bit ticked off because you're not getting the minutes. But, you know, that guy, even though he's not here on Tuesday, he's practiced Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday with an NBL team. And you missed two mornings this week. But you still want to kind of come at me about minutes, you know. So that made those conversations easier. And usually those athletes are pretty good and be like, oh, okay, yep. You know, I'm just kind of, sorry, coach, I'm a little bit ticked off because, you know, of course I want to be playing. And it's like, yeah, great. Yeah, we love that you want to be playing. You're being competitive. But there's a standard that comes with that that we spoke about that's hanging in your locker that you're not, you know, that you're not aligning with right now. So that was the way that we kind of got out in front of it. But like what you say, it's not like we didn't have problems throughout the season, but it was a good way to get a jump on it.
So, did that change when you had people that weren't necessarily pro athletes but were pro like careers?
Yeah. I can't speak for the men's side, but on the women's side, you have to be accommodating of careers. You know, it's the end of the day, especially if NBL 1 sort of level is the highest that they're playing and going to play or want to play, the majority of their income will not come from playing at that level. So you do have to be mindful and accommodating, but there also needs to be things met halfway. So we had an athlete at Knox, actually, who is a lawyer and very, very all the hours that come with that and the expectation that come with that. And so we sat her down with the group and just said, hey, this is what it's going to be for me. And, you know, I just need some understanding and all that sort of stuff. And if you have any problems, please come and speak to us and all that sort of stuff. But I had her deliver that message because I think it probably gets accepted a little better from the athlete rather than from me.
Yeah, it's not dictating from your end. It's accepting
it's their message. There's an empathy that then comes with that rather than shut up, coach. So everyone was great. All the girls were great and super understanding that, you know, there were times where, yeah, she'd have to miss practice because, you know, there was a case on the next day and, you know, she's cramming all that information together that, you know, all that sort of stuff that you know, comes with demanding jobs. And it wasn't just the demanding jobs. There's also, you know, what people would perceive to be everyday jobs. You know, like we had teachers that had parent-teacher interviews those nights and I cannot turn around and say, no, you'll be at practice. No, you have to go to work.
I mean, yeah, it's similar. Like you say, life, like when you're dealing with senior athletes, there's a reasonable chance that some of those senior athletes will have a child.
Yep.
So, like, you've got to deal with that phone call 15 minutes before practice and say, hey, look, my child's crook. Yep. Like, I can't come into the session that night. And you've got to wear that.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing absolutely you can do about it. Like, there's and life outside basketball.
The worst
enough
thing you can do is make them feel guilty for it, especially when it comes to their families and their children. If you have even a hint of hostility in your voice, you'll lose that athlete. Maybe not from a walkout perspective, but definitely from a relationship perspective. So, whilst, you know, I don't have kids of my own, I'm very understanding of those that do and the requirements that come with that and all those sort of things. But that's where it's really important that it's laid out at the start of the season of the expectations of the group. And if they meet all those expectations and then, you know, can't make a session or, you know, it's not looked at by the rest of the group as, oh, this is ridiculous. You know, it's, we knew this was potentially coming. They've made everything else. They just need this night off because, you know, their partner's stuck at work and can't come and relieve them to look after the kids or whatever it might be, or, you know, work's on or those sort of things. So it's when we talk about also like pro, like WNBL and athletes coming in late and all that sort of stuff, it really does come down to the old everybody's treated fair but not equal. You know, the standards remain the same for everybody, but certain things will differ for different people, and it happens on court. Coaches that don't subscribe to this or say they don't subscribe to this are lying, because every team, even on court, there will be players that have just a little bit longer reach for error. You know, they might make an error and you go, ah, we'll let that go. and you continue on. Where there are some where they start to make the error and you know that error 2, 3, 4, 5 is coming, so you yank them, and that may be seen as unfair. Well, no, it's not unfair. It's just not equal. And that's the sort of thing. But, you know, the expectation of if you can't come to practice, you've got to put that in the group and all that, that remains the same for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's where it is fair. The level of communication, the level of respect, all that sort of stuff is the same for everybody. But it's got to be something that is relayed, and I'm probably a little bit different in the sense of having them all together. I'll speak to them one-on-one and say, right, in or out with this? Are you accepting of this or not? Probably more from a female perspective, they're even less likely in a group to be the one person to go, actually, I don't agree with this. So in a one-on-one, they're probably more likely to do it. So that's how I'd approach that. But again, having it come from the athlete holds a lot more weight than having it come from me.
Yep. So, Coops, you've been in this role. Why is the youth league coach the worst job in the world? I'll preface this, it's not, but it does feel that way at times.
Yeah, no, it definitely isn't, but yeah, it's littered with those moments. You're a feeder team, and you know, the whole reason we have that league is to have an underpinning league for your semi-professional league. That's the whole reason it's there. It's literally a pathway competition.
Yep. Development focus.
Development focus. That's exactly. You know, can we help the athletes move from juniors to seniors, or juniors to college, or whatever may be happening? And of course, as soon as your professional team starts losing bodies, where do they need to get them from? Your team. And so the amount of times you have this amazing practice plan and scout, and you're all ready to go this week, and then it's like, oh, I've got 7 players this week, but on Saturday I'll have 12. And it's like, okay, yeah, all right, that's a bit of a headache. And obviously all our youth league friends out there, you know exactly what we're talking about. But having said that, it is a great way to start connecting with your professional team. You know, because obviously if you're coaching youth league, you probably have the ambition to move up the line. So it allows you to start connecting more closely, you know, with your head coach, your professional head coach, start getting involved in their environment. You know, a lot of coaches are usually pretty good that if there isn't a clash on a weekend, maybe you can go sit on the bench or be in the locker room. You know, you can start developing that ability of, okay, how do I actually develop this athlete? What do I actually give this athlete to help them transition from youth to professional? And that's a real skill. Like, and that's something.
You're only talking top down. Then you've also got bottom up,
yeah,
right? Like, because
yeah,
often in youth coaches. League, you've, yeah, yeah, that's you've right. also you've also got the 18s or maybe even potentially 16s, depending on the athlete, yeah, and things like that. And so you got to work all that in together. So from that perspective, if you have, say, a top age under 18 athlete in your program, and they start to get niggles or things like that, the rule generally is youth league is the first thing to go.
Yeah.
So now you've lost another athlete. Oh. The top down has said, I'm going to take these 4, thanks very much, and all of a sudden you're running indies.
Yeah, you are lowest person on totem pole as the youth league coach, and that's hardest right. thing to understand. Is
but,
that?
But it's the vital. Most important Absolutely. At a club. Yeah. Like, yep. And I'm not saying that because, that's you know, flippant. We're trying it's to... Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is so important. To me, if I was in charge of any... club at any sort of, I guess, level that matters, I wouldn't care if the youth league team lost. My level of success for the youth league coach would be how many can transition into that senior yep. program. And it's really important to understand that. And again, we're all coaches. We all want to win, completely understand that. But that's when it starts to get like that, when you're copying it from all angles and you're maybe not winning games and things like that, you have to hold on tight to the fact that, you know, you might have 1, 2, 3 athletes over a few different age groups that could potentially transition in, and that's what you've got to focus on and you know, keep it as a as something to keep you going, because it is really easy at times to go, I don't even know why I'm doing this.
Yeah, and that is a myth also that, oh, you won youth league, so you're a good coach. Well, not necessarily.
Like, you got a bunch of 22-year-olds, yeah, you're going to win. Should in that you're going to win.
Like, there's a big window there. Like, you're from 22 down. Like, I suppose, at what age do we want some of our junior athletes to start stepping into senior basketball? Like, what's the age? And it's, I mean, there's no number, I suppose, in that space as well. Like, if you've got a legitimately good 14-year-old, are you going to play them in seniors? Probably not. Like, in fact, I would suggest don't.
No.
But it's one of those things too where you do have to be a little bit careful that their junior program is still being serviced in that space, because they are still a junior athlete. But you're preparing them not necessarily to win games. You're preparing them to go and play the next level up. And that's, I think, the real test of success of a youth league coach is not the title at the end of the year. It's like, how many can now transition up? How many opportunities are you giving for kids to come through your program and through your pathway to go up and have an opportunity at a higher level? Because that's the real test.
I also think that it's what sort of impact have you made on the senior team from a competitive standpoint, from a resource standpoint. So, but again, like that's your job, is to support the senior team and have this pathway. So, you know, a lot of senior programs now practice together.
Mm.
So, you know, do you have a youth league culture and team that's ultra competitive, have great attention to detail, you know, play hard and can actually move fluidly through the senior team and back down to 18s, making those two teams better? Or even best case scenario, actually play against your NBL 1 team on a Thursday night as like a scout team or something like that, that gives them real reps actually playing together as a team. I mean, if you can do that, plus that ability that both you guys are talking about to actually, you know, develop kids and move them up the pathway, you're really starting to do something special with that group, and you're going to build out a body of work and a resume that's going to help you go on.
Yeah, sure. I think when you talk about, you know, what age should athletes be transitioning in and all that sort of stuff, from a female perspective, you know, bottom age 18s, I think in the youth league space, they can start to sort of
look at it
and get involved, especially depending on the athlete, as long as they are not what is pinning up the program. So what I mean by that, I was at a club coaching 18s one year, and six of the girls were in the youth league team and a big part of it, you know, playing big minutes and things like that. That can't be the case. You know, that's got to be that they come in and complement a group that's there that's, you know, aged out, you know, the last 1, 2, 3 years, rather than, oh, we'll just rely on the 18s to or 16s for some to come in and hold up the program. You know, the last thing as a coach you want is an athlete in your youth league program that's there for, you know, 6 years. Like, you want to be 2, maybe 3 years, so 1 year once they're out of juniors, and then moving on.
Well, and looking at the standard too, there are a number of years where, and it happens in the girls, I find, more than so than the boys, and that's just a physical thing.
Yeah.
A lot of years, the under 18 girls competition tends to be better than the youth league competition, whereas in the boys it doesn't tend to happen because, you know, you're playing against a 22-year-old rookie or someone like that just bumps that cutter, and all of a sudden you fly into the fourth row of the stand. Like, it's a very different space in that world. I know I said this was going to be a short podcast, but somehow the aircon's kicked in the gauge room. I don't know what's happened here, but we've gone a little bit longer than I anticipated.
Or we're hallucinating.
Yeah, well, very real possibility. I don't know what's happened, but either way, very nice in here at the moment.
Yes.
So we will wrap it up there for this week. There's actually a whole bunch more topics that we could sort of dive into, I feel like, with the senior coaching. So we might revisit this in a few weeks' time when we've got a little bit more time, and fingers crossed the aircon will be working at that stage. But thank you both for jumping into the podcast this week. It is appreciated. We're on next week, Coops. I'm going to give you word of warning now. 9:30 next Tuesday morning, the topic's shooting.
Here we go.
Like,
are we even required?
No, we're not.
this is a single person lock the doors
monologue.
Like
we're not even going to bother. Like,
hood on, candlelight only.
I'll walk in, I'll hit the record button, I'll walk out, just text me when you're done. And we'll sort it out from there. But the coaches, once again, thanks for jumping into the podcast. We do appreciate all the listens and all the feedback we get from that. As a reminder, we do have a mailbag episode coming up. That'll be probably the last week of November, I feel like that's going to be, or maybe the first week of December. Potentially, depending on how many questions we get, might be 2 weeks. We'll see how we go with that. But if there is anything you want discussed in there, please do send an email, or you can get Zoe Carr on Twitter with the handle
at ZoeCarr85.
You can get Coops
at CoachNCB.
You can get me at Rob Coulter. Don't bother trying to get Bestie on Twitter. He's gone full Elon Musk and is just like, no, not interested in this whatsoever. We will catch you guys next week on the podcast. Good luck with your coaching during the week. Look, tune in and join the tribe on iTunes.